part of the standard model. There's a non-abelian engaged theory with spontaneous symmetry breaking, and it incorporates the Fermi theory. It as an approximation in some limit. It incorporates quantum electrodynamics. It is separate from but consistent with QCD, and it is a mathematically consistent theory that we believe is correct, to at least to an excellent approximation. So, however, Fermi theory breaks down at high energies. And that's just manifested by the fact that it's not unitary and it is non-renormalizable. These are closely related diseases. It's very hard to write a long word on the blackboard, even if I can write it easily under other circumstances. Okay, and it also has some problems, some bad loop predictions. For kaon physics. And all of these things are fixed up in the standard model. Actually, this last one, which I probably won't talk about today, but I'll talk about next week a little bit, is fixed up more by the introduction of the charm quark, so that there's that the S is, remember in the Fermi theory, this S quark was off by itself in some funny way. And when one introduced the charm quark, that actually fixed up this last one. So I'm going to concentrate right now on these first two aspects. But the implication is that one needs a better theory, or a more complete, I should say. Now, the unitary problem is easy to illustrate. Let's just consider cross-section for electron neutrino. Electron goes to electron neutrino electron. I've talked mainly about decay processes so far, but you can certainly have scattering processes. When all this was first developed, people hadn't actually observed things like this, but nowadays there's all kinds of neutrino scattering processes that are measured. And this particular reaction in the Fermi theory, this goes by so you have a J mu dagger here. And you can calculate the cross-section for this process. And one finds that the cross-section is, well, the sigma is equal to, or it goes like G Fermi squared S over pi, where S is just the center of mass energy squared. And this is an approximation valid for ECM much greater than the electron mass. So it's a straightforward calculation. Now, the problem with this is it is pure S wave. That is, the four fermions are right on top of each other in the interaction, so there's no orbital angular momentum involved. And if you'll remember your scattering theory in quantum mechanics, you can do the partial wave expansion in which you take the incoming plane wave and decompose it into partial waves of definite orbital angular momentum. And it's only the S wave that contributes to this. There's no angular dependence or anything. And you may or may not also remember from your scattering theory in in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and these issues are the same, have nothing to do, are just rotational issues. They have nothing to do with whether it's relativistic or not. There is, in the partial wave expansion, there is a condition, partial wave unitarity. Unitarity basically means conservation of probability, but it states that the S wave cross-section is bounded at high energy for any process, for any elastic process, by 16 pi over S. So therefore, clearly, the cross-section becomes unphysical. So it breaks down. It violates unitarity for, I'll write it this way, E center mass over 2 greater than or equal to root pi over G Fermi, which is about 500 GeV. So it was recognized from very early days, for reasons like this, that the Fermi theory was only a low-energy approximation, and that clearly it had to, it broke, would break down at high energies. And of course, that didn't matter too much when the experimental energies were much less than this, but it became very important later. Now, by itself, this is not too disturbing, because again, if you had a segment on scattering theory in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you undoubtedly studied a Born approximation to scattering amplitudes for potential scattering. And usually, for virtually all, you know, well-behaved potentials, in Born approximations, just in quantum mechanics, cross-sections do violate unitarity at high energies. So that's not surprising. It's only an artifact of the Born approximation. And Born approximation is equivalent to tree level, first order. And in quantum mechanics, one fixes that up if you calculate the higher orders, second, you know, higher order Born approximation. It turns out that that fixes up the problem. And one gets better, well-behaved cross-sections that are consistent with unitarity. So that's not surprising. But so let's go to higher orders. Well, if one, the next order, just taking this as a field theory, would be this diagram, where you have two Fermi, four Fermi interactions. And so this would be a nu E, an E minus, nu E, E minus, nu E, E minus. So this is the first, this is the one loop correction. Now, I haven't talked at all about loop diagrams or anything. I think you saw a little bit in your field theory segments. But the main point is that at higher energies, I have to integrate, let me call this the four momentum of this internal electron. And it turns out that when you go through the calculation, and if one's at very high energies, so that one can ignore if what I'm trying to say is you have to integrate over k. So if this momentum is k, then this physical momentum would be P nu E plus P E minus minus K would be the momentum in this line. And you have to do some sort of loop integral, D4K. And then you have to put in the propagators for these two fermions. Well, if P nu E and P E minus are finite, when you have to integrate over all K. And basically, I don't want to go into this in detail, at very large k, the two propagators would just look like k slash over k squared and k slash over k squared. And since k is going to infinity, you've got basically something like d4k over k to the 4 and then a k squared upstairs. And when you let each component of k goes to infinity, that diverges horribly. It's a quadratic divergence. That's non-renormalizability. And unlike one that we'll find in the Higgs sector, this one cannot be absorbed just into a redefinition, renormalization of the Fermi constant or anything like that. So these are just meaningless and cannot be easily. You could redefine the Fermi constant to take that divergence into account, but then it would show up in other places. You can't do it in a sort of universal way that would apply to all processes. So the non-renormalizability, which is by itself a disease, prevents you from curing the unitarity problem. The two are closely linked. Yes?
So could we not use a cutoff and still use the theory? Why does it have to be?
Well, you could use a cutoff. But then the question is, what is the origin of that cutoff? And in fact, that's what the standard model basically does. It puts in a cutoff at the scale in which you have to take into account the W and Z propagators and other diagrams. But if you're just purely in the Fermi theory, then you're in trouble. And again, and what non-renormalizable means also is, well, let me try to say this. I could try to cut off the integral at some large scale lambda, and I'd get something from this that's proportional to G Fermi squared times lambda squared. And I could say that G Fermi, which is the tree level, plus this would be some renormalizable G Fermi, or renormalized G Fermi, and then this process would be taken care of. The trouble is it wouldn't be a universal thing. You could find other diagrams that would require every process would require a different renormalization. That's what we mean by non-renormalizable. So, but one can try to put in a cutoff in a more physical way. And that's the intermediate vector boson theory. I'm not going to write it out. Intermediate vector boson. This was actually sort of proposed in Yukawa's paper, the same paper in which he talked about the meson theory, but it was really developed by Schwinger in 1957. And the idea was, let's make the theory look more like QED by getting rid of the four Fermi interaction, and instead say that there is some electrically charged particle, let's call it the W here, a massive spin one particle that is exchanged. And let's say there's some coupling here at each end. And so if this is the case, first of all, the amplitude for this or for, can do the same thing for my neutrino electron scattering, for any of the processes, this would be W plus. Basically, the amplitude now, let's look at this one, not trying to keep track of factors of two and so forth, would be something like G squared over Q squared minus MW squared, where Q is the momentum carried by the propagator. Well, this, and let me just throw in a minus sign. I'm not trying to keep the coefficients. I just want to make it look simpler. So there's some coefficient, and just arbitrarily, I'm sticking a minus sign here just to make it look simpler. So clearly, if Q squared in magnitude is very much smaller than MW squared, this just goes as G squared over MW squared. And so now one would have a field theory with a propagator. And it turns out that this more or less, well, the new E minus goes to new E E minus is now better behaved. It basically solves the problem of the S wave unitarity, because now, since there is an exchange here, it's no longer pure S wave. And it basically solves that problem. The difficulty is now we've introduced this spin, this particle into the theory, and we have to take that into account. And now, so there are other physical processes involving these bosons. For example, you could have E minus, E plus, nu, W minus, W plus. And it turns out now this violates unitarity at about the same energy. So we've solved one problem and created another problem. Incidentally, I forgot to say, a priori, one can't predict this MW. All you can predict is G. Clearly, this G squared over MW squared is something like the Fermi constant. It has the right dimensions. Fermi theory is just an approximation. And but one can only predict the ratio, G over MW. However, for G of order E, the electric charge of the positron, just of order, one gets MW is of order 100 GeV, 100 times the proton mass. And it's not too surprising, 100 GeV, 500 GeV, let's not quibble about a factor of five. That, I mean, those are the same energy, so it's not surprising that that's sort of the same energy at which unitarity problems occur. Yes?
So why did we choose D to be order of E? Just
why did I choose what?
It's, so you, is there, we chose G to be of order of
E. Just as an illustration, if you want to choose G to be 10 to the minus 5E, then you'll get MW 10 to the 5 times larger. But if you're just going to guess something to get the feel, this is what you would guess. Okay, so one can fix this up. Introduce a third W0. And by the way, obviously this is massive, and one has the problem, we know we can't really construct a renormalizable field theory for massive W's. But so this is, at some level, it's bound to be problematic. And in the end, one's never going to totally solve the problems that way. But I'm just trying to sort of motivate the thinking here. But one can introduce another electrically neutral particle, and then such that there would be another diagram for this process. W minus W plus with a three-point vertex here. And basically, one can solve the unitarity problem for this, as well as you have to simultaneously solve the related problems for, say, neutrino electron goes to W minus plus W zero and all of them. In the end, you have to choose these vertices. You won't get a cancellation unless you properly choose all the vertices. And to cancel all the problems, you basically have to have that the commutator of the two currents, charge raising and lowering currents, is proportional to the current to which it describes this vertex. Or if you integrate the time components, it would be saying like some Q for Q and Q dagger would be proportional to the charge operator associated with this new one. Well, this should be starting to look like a non-abelian gauge theory. And so one can actually semi-derive the standard model by this sort of reasoning. Now, I'm not going to pursue it further. This algebra actually turns out to be that of an SU2 symmetry, and one could get a partially successful theory this way. It would not be a realistic theory because it would not have any room for the electromagnetism in it. However, in around 1961, Sheldon Glashow, proposed a similar construction, but really just starting from the viewpoint of a non-abelian gauge theory, which had not only the SU2, but a second U1, and cross means that the two groups commute. And basically, this predicted W plus, W minus, W zero, and a new boson that we'll call B, and linear combinations of the W0 and B are not mass eigenstates, but linear combinations are the massless photon and another massive particle called the Z. And that was the standard model that he wrote down, except that he didn't have any, he put in masses by hand. It was a chiral symmetry because of parity violation. So the fermion masses and the WZ masses, he just put them in by hand. And we know that doing that violates the gauge invariance. And he didn't, so it really was not a successful theory. But as far as the interactions and the identity of the particles, it was the standard model. The idea was revived independently by Weinberg and independently Salam a few years later, and they restated the SU2 cross U1 model, but with the Higgs mechanism. So instead of putting in all these masses by hand, they were absent because they wanted a renormalizable gauge theory, but they were generated by spontaneous symmetry breaking. And I think you've already seen a little bit how you can generate a fermion, chiral fermion mass by giving a VEB to a scalar field. And we'll see today or Monday how the same thing works for gauge bosons in the Higgs mechanism. And I don't want to go much more into history. Their theory was really, at that time, they still didn't have the strange quark, the charm quark, and so there were inconsistencies involving the strange quark, which were solved a few years later by when the charm quark was discovered. And it had been, I should say, that the GEM mechanism, Glashow, Iliopoulos, Maiani, had already argued around 1970 that by putting in a fourth quark, all the problems could be solved. And then this fourth quark was discovered a few years later. It was proved to be renormalizable in 71. By Etouft. Is there anybody from the Netherlands here? That's good, because no person who's not a native speaker can pronounce the name properly. And I'm not a native speaker, so Dutch. So, Tuft and Veltman. And then finally, about the same time, this theory incorporated the Fermi theory and QED, and it predicted new interactions mediated by this extra boson, and it predicted the existence of the W and Z. And starting just a year or two after that, the new interactions were observed, and eventually the W and Z were observed and their properties intensely studied over the next 20 years, 25 years or so. Okay, that's the sort of the historical sketch, which I gave not so much because of the history, but just to try to give some motivation for why a non-abelian gauge theory can be relevant to these issues. Let me write down the standard model first in a cartoon form and then in equations. So basically, we have for the standard model the group SU3, that's QCD, cross SU2 cross U1. This is the electroweak part. There are three gauge couplings that can be different, called GS, G, and G prime. The fermions in the first family are as follows. You have left chiral up and down quarks and right chiral up and down quarks. And this just indicates these are the red ones under the color quantum number. And when I put the two in a column vector like that, that's going to indicate that under SU2, these are a doublet, and here these are singlets under SU2. Then you repeat this pattern for the other colors of quarks. And you repeat the pattern for the blue ones. And you repeat the pattern for the leptons. I've assumed here that there is a right-handed neutrino. For the sake of simplicity, we're hopefully on Thursday or so next week, I'll talk about that, but let's just assume there is one. So the SU3, and I can also write this in a more simplified language, for example, U alpha, D alpha, left, where alpha is red, green, or blue is the color index. Or an even simpler way is to just suppress the color index entirely and not even display it, which is usually fine if I'm talking about the weak interactions. So these are three different notations. Now, the SU3 makes transitions between the different colors. Some of them are diagonal. The third and eighth generator just take U red into U red. Other generators would take U red into green red, et cetera. And those are the same. So the SU3 transitions just go this way and are the same for left and right. They're non-chiral. They don't act on the leptons. And you can extend this to three families, and it's the same picture for the second and third family. So that's SU3. The SU2 transitions act in this direction. They rotate up into down, and they do it the same way there for the three colors. The two groups commute. So you simultaneously take each color up into each color down, without ever mixing colors, and also for the leptons. But the SU2 is chiral. The right-handed, right chiral fields don't participate. They're singlets under SU2. One of the SU2 generators, the third one, is diagonal. So instead of up to down, it just is up to up and down to down. And similarly, the U1, U1 is phase transformations. Just like the third component of SU2. And so under the U1, I'll just write any field, phi j, whether it's spin a half, whether it's left, right, whatever it is, just goes into some e to the I g prime times what we call the charge. This is called the weak hypercharge. It's an analog of electric charge, and each of these fields has some charge. G prime is the gauge coupling. So they each have some phase transformation. Now, if I were to be as general as possible, I would pretend that I don't know what those weak hypercharges are. By the way, the weak hypercharge is not the same as strong hypercharge. For some fields, it overlaps. For some, it doesn't. I could pretend that I don't know a priori what these weak hypercharges are. I could then go through everything that I'm going to do for the rest of today and Monday, and in the end realize, well, I can actually be in agreement with experiment if I pick them in such and such a way. I think it will be easier pedantically if I just tell you what they are now, understanding that if you were writing this theory for the first time, you wouldn't know until you went through it a couple times. For each particle, well, Q, the electric charge generator or operator, is the third component of weak hypercharge of SU2 plus the weak hypercharge generator. And that means for a given particle, QI is T3I plus YI. This is the relation that works and will correspond to what we actually see. And once again, this is something you would have to go through the whole calculation to arrive at this. So for example, the electric charge of the left-handed up quark is 2/3. The T3 for the right-handed up quark is plus 1/2 plus Y. That means YU at left is 1/6. Q for the down quark, it's minus 1/3, is minus 1/2 plus YDL. So YDL is 1/6, the same. And that's not surprising because U1 is supposed to commute with SU2, so it should be the same Y for each element of an SU2 doublet. Similarly, the Y for new left equals y of e minus left is minus 1/2. So that, for example, the charge of the neutrino left is 0, and the charge of e minus left is minus 1. And for the right-handed fields, the T3 is 0. So the right-handed fields, the y is always the same as the electric charge. In addition to these gauge symmetries, there are some approximate Faber symmetries. For example, there's isospin, in which up and down are rotated in each other. And isospin, the original form of it, was left and right are the same. And that partially overlaps an SU2 generator. So, and I alluded to that yesterday when talking about SU3 currents. Some of those approximate global symmetries of the strong interactions partially overlap the currents or charges associated with the SU2, but it's only a partial overlap. So that confuses things even more. Yes?
In principle, could that relation Q equals T3 plus Y have been any linear combination and it just happens to be? Yeah, I know you said that experimentally that's the way it is, but is it constrained by theory at all?
In the end, well, the answer is yes, it is constrained because if I were to have written some different linear combination, then I could, it would have to be a linear combination. Otherwise, I would not get something that has, could not get something that has electric charges that coincide with the real world. But for any linear combination, I could have gone through the whole calculation. Some of the details of the calculation would look different, just as if I did a problem with a spins and magnetic moments, and if I had chosen to put the magnetic moment this way, but my z-axis that way, the calculation would have looked different, but in the end it would be the same. And what would, in the end, I would find that all the physics would be the same, but I'd have to sort of redefine some of these fields. They would be linear combinations of the electron and neutrino and all that. But again, the physics would be the same. Okay, so now I'm ready to write down the Lagrangian of the theory. So, and I'm going to now completely ignore QCD. That's just acts on this color space that's completely orthogonal, commutes with everything I'm going to talk about now. So I'm not going to write color indices. Yes?
On the same question, does this restrict the, how you go from mass eigenstates to SU2 plus U1 eigenstates? This Q, T3, and Y relation?
It turns out that no. This is, well, this is related to the relation of the W0 and B goes to the Z in gamma. If that's what you mean, the answer is yes. So the Lagrangian for SU2 cross U1 is a gauge piece, a scalar piece. This is the Higgs, which I haven't introduced yet. A fermion piece and a Yukawa interaction connecting the fermions and the scalars. This is just the basic tree level. There are also, when you really go through all the intricacies of the field theory, there's also gauge fixing terms, but that's beyond what's needed for my purposes. The gauge part is just minus a quarter F mu nu I F mu nu I minus a quarter B mu nu B mu nu, where F mu nu I is the SU2 part. So this is D mu W nu I, and I should say W is W plus, W minus, W zero is, you know, it's, or you can write W1, W2, and W3. It doesn't matter. W1 and W plus and minus is 1 over root 2 W1 minus or plus I W2, and W0 is the same as W3. And I guess I used upper. Let me be consistent. Okay. So it's this minus D nu W mu I plus I G, or minus G epsilon I J K W mu J W mu K. So this is the totally anti-symmetric tensor. This is the gauge coupling for SU2, and this is the familiar non-abelian gauge field strength tensor, and so this leads to 3 and 4 point vertices for the proportional to g and g squared, as well as to the normal kinetic energy for these. B mu nu, this is a U1 group, so this is just d mu b mu minus d nu b mu, and b is the gauge boson for SU2, for U1. And again, B and W3 are not going to be mass eigenstates. They will mix to be the photon and the Z. Okay, now for L phi, I will introduce the Higgs boson. I must introduce a complex spin zero field, actually two of them, an SU2 doublet, phi plus and phi zero. These are both complex fields, and they transform as a doublet under SU2. And the Q, the Y of for this doublet is plus 1/2. That means that the charge of the upper one is 1/2 plus 1/2 equals 1. The charge, electric charge here is minus 1/2 plus 1/2, it's 0. I have two complex scalar fields, and I can also just emphasize the adjoint of phi would be what I call phi minus and phi zero dagger. The Lagrangian density, L phi, consists of a usual gauge covariant derivative minus a potential. The gauge covariant derivative of this doublet is the ordinary derivative times the 2 by 2 identity matrix. And then, since this is an SU2 doublet, I have to introduce a coupling to the SU2 gauge fields. So it's tau I wi mu over 2. So that's the SU2 representation matrix for the doublet. And then, since this also transforms under U1, I have to add a term, IG prime B mu over 2. Generally, for all of these things, what I really should have written there was IG prime times the charge of the phi, the U1 charge, the weak hypercharge B mu. But I've simply used the fact that y is 1/2. But I mean, generally, you would put in the appropriate charge. Yes?
Just being clear, for the SU2 doublets, their weak hypercharge have to be the same, right?
Yes. That's just a statement that SU2 commutes with U1. If I tried to choose them different, then it would really be introducing a bigger group, not just a direct product. And you could try to do that, but that's not what I'm doing here. Okay, so that's the gauge covariant derivative. And that, of course, will mean that we have terms like this, phi with the W's or B. And we will also have Siegel-type interactions involving two gauge bosons. Okay, V, and I don't want to write them out in detail at this point. V for complex scalar, well, there's only two terms that you can write consistent with renormalizability, phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And of course, phi dagger phi is, if you just look at that, it would be phi plus dagger phi plus phi 0 dagger phi 0, which is phi minus phi plus phi 0 dagger phi 0. There's no special name given to the phi 0 dagger. So. And so this, of course, leads to four-point vertices, and this is a mass-type term. And we will always take lambda positive, just as we did when I talked about the Goldstone theorem and spontaneous breaking. I did the same sort of calculation. I just had a one field, not two fields. But the idea was the same. This is needed for vacuum stability or for V bounded below. And we will take, mu squared could be positive or negative or zero in principle, but I will take mu squared less than zero because I anticipate I will want to be doing spontaneous breaking. The fermion part is equal to sum m equals 1 to 3. I'm just summing over the three families, q bar m left I b slash U, I'm sorry, B slash Q M left plus L bar Q left is U U1 is the up quark, U2 is the charm quark, U3 is the top quark, et cetera. And L M left is just nu M E minus M left, where this is the electron, muon, and tau. So for the two left-handed doublets and for the four right-handed SU2 singlets, each has a kinetic energy term. The covariant derivatives are different for them. I'm not going to put a little label Q left here, but I mean each covariant derivative depends on the transformations of that set of fields. And I don't want to keep writing the M, so I will write this as Q bar left I D slash Q left plus all the others, where I just use a matrix notation for the family index. Okay, the covariant derivatives are d mu q left is d mu plus ij t tau I over 2 w mu I plus I g prime over 6 b mu q left d mu l left d mu plus I g tau I over 2 w mu I minus I g prime over 2 b mu l left.
So yes? We're neglecting luons?
Pardon me?
We're neglecting luons?
I said I'm not going to write down the QCD part. That commutes, that acts on the separate space of colors that I'm not doing. So, but yes, I mean, if you wanted to put in the color indices as well, then every one of these terms would have a 3x3 identity matrix in color space, and then you would have the gluon terms, which each of which would have a identity in the SU2 space. The d mu you write is d mu plus I 2/3 g prime d mu q right. This is u right. This is an SU2 singlet, so there's no w term, and this and for the right-handed, the y coincides with the electric charge. Yeah.
How do we know this term is diagonal in flavor space? How do we know there are no, not cross terms between flavors?
Oh, you mean between the three families?
Yeah, families. Sorry, not three.
Because at this point we don't know anything about masses. All fermions are massless, and I'm going to simply say there that the left-handed quarks form an irreducible representation consisting of three doublets. And I can simply say a reducible representation of three doublets means that there are three terms, each of which is diagonal and no cross terms. Now, at some point, I'm going to have to figure out those may not coincide precisely with the mass eigenstates. And so what I'm calling U and D and C and S, I tried to simplify the notation, actually. What I really should have done was write U0, D0 left, C0, S0 left. And now these are just what we would call the weak eigenstates. This is a doublet. This is a doublet. And by sort of definition, it's diagonal. However, these two can mix to form the mass eigenstates. These two can mix to form mass eigenstates. So that's, and in which I wouldn't have the superscript 0. I left off the zeros here just to make the notation simpler. But that's going to be the origin of the Kabibel mixing, because D and S, D0 and S0 actually are going to be linear combinations by that Kabibel angle I talked about last time of the mass eigenstates. Okay, anything else? Okay, let me just finish this. So this is so each time I put the electric charge for right-handed fields, and the new right has no charge. It's an SU2 singlet, and so it doesn't have any gauge interactions. Okay, so now one can actually read off all the vertices from here. A WI mu, and this vertex will always be able to form minus I G over 2 times tau I, and there's always a gamma mu, and then there's going to be a 1 minus gamma I over 2. because this is the thing that says it only acts on the left-handed fields, not the right-handed. So, and the tau just, you know, if this was A and B, it would be tau BA here, tau AB. Similarly, the B it's minus I G prime times the Y for whatever field is here, it's the appropriate Y times gamma mu, and then 1 minus or plus gamma 5 over 2. The minus if it's a left-handed, and it's plus if it's right-handed. Yeah?
Didn't you already project out the left and right hands by just writing only that part of the spinner? Like by writing QL?
L and R are the projections. They've got the projections built into them. QL is PLQ. So it's built into it. So that's the fermion part. Finally, let me write the Yukawa interaction, the thing that can connect the fermions and the Higgs. And that will ultimately lead to the possibility of masses for the fermions. I put minus here because it saves putting a sign on the other side. This is Yukawa coupling between the scalar, the Higgs, and the fermions. Remember, that type of interaction always connects right chiral fields to left chiral fields. So it is the sum, M and N, running from 1 to 3. And let me start with the one for the down quark. Phi. Right. Plus Hermitian conjugate. Plus U, D, and new terms that are similar. But let me just talk about this one. Gamma D, M, N, is a 3x3 matrix in family space. M and N are the family indices. And the superscript D simply means there's going to be one such matrix for each sector, for the down quarks, for the up quarks. This should have been for the electrons and for the neutrinos. So there's four such matrices, and I just labeled this way. It is square matrix. It does not have to be Hermitian. It does not have to be symmetric. It does not have to be real. It does not have to have any property except that it is square. Fermion mass matrices have that property, and it's one of the few places in quantum mechanics that you encounter non-Hermitian matrices. Because the reason it can be non-Hermitian is because it's taking right into left, and you have to add Hermitian conjugate to this. So this does not by itself have to be Hermitian. And this is called the Yukawa matrix. An analogy to the Yukawa theory. And I can rewrite this term by just expanding it out. Well, I can rewrite it first of all as Q bar left gamma D phi D right, where now I'm really taking this to be like a matrix, M, M, N, N, and these column vector and row vector. And this has the form of gamma D, M, N, I'm restoring the indices again, U bar M left phi plus the n right plus u bar m left phi 0. This is d bar phi 0 d n right plus Hermitian conjugate. Now the point to note is that, you know, I just expanded out the SU2 part here, u bar phi plus d, this is plus not dagger, and d bar phi 0 d. So first of all, I've chosen all my hypercharges so that electric charge is conserved here. Technically, we don't know about electric charge. You can pretend that you never heard of it, and when I'm just, these are labels. We haven't gotten electromagnetism out of this yet. But at any rate, my point is, if phi 0 not equal to 0, if it has a vacuum expectation value, that will generate a down quark mass, interpreted as just a phi 0 taking d n right into d m left. And it will be a mass matrix, actually, if m is not equal to n, and one will have to diagonalize this. That's how there'll be a mismatch between mass and weak eigenstates. So that's all very fine for this term. But I need to do something similar, and I can do something very similar for the gamma E, for the electron. I can write a, if I simply replaced the L bar left and E electron right and put an E up here, I have exactly the same structure. However, I run into some trouble if I want to do the same thing for the up quarks. Since the top quark is 170 GeV, I'd better do something for those. For the up quarks, and also for the neutrino, if I want to have a mass term, for the up quarks, what I would have to have is something of the form Q bar left gamma up, a different 2-3 by 3 matrix, times something, some multiplet phi u right, where phi is a scalar doublet with components phi 0 and phi minus, and with y of this phi would be plus, would be minus a half rather than the plus a half I had for my little phi. That's because the u right has a different hypercharge than the d right, and so the field that couples here has to have a different hypercharge. So that this would give something of the form u bar left phi 0 u right plus d bar left phi minus d right. And this would conserve electric charge. If I tried to put a little phi in here, you see I would have had a phi plus here and it wouldn't have made any sense. I would be violating weak hypercharge and electric charge. So I need a different doublet. Apparently I need a second doublet of Higgs's with a opposite hypercharge. And in the supersymmetric extension of the standard model, indeed, one does introduce such a doublet and a lot of other extensions. However, there's a trick in the standard model, and one can actually get by without the second doublet. That's because in the standard model, phi tilt, well, the point is that the 2 and the 2 star of representations of SU2 are actually equivalent. There is no separate 2 star. The 2 and 2 star are related by a unitary transformation. And technically, the phi transforms as a 2, and this could be thought of as a 2 star. Mathematically, all I have to do is define a quantity phi tilde. You can erase that sign. Phi tilde, which is I tau 2 times phi adjoint, which is phi 0 dagger minus phi minus. This is technically, this is a 2 star representation, but this transformation takes me back to a 2, but with the opposite hypercharge. So this is called the tilde trick. One does not need an independent separate phi. One can simply have q bar left gamma u phi tilde u right plus Hermitian conjugate, and similarly for the neutrinos. And then this is will become just phi. This is, will become phi zero dagger. And so again, if phi zero acquires an expectation value, it will be able to give a mass to the up quark. Again, this trick does not generalize very well. If you tried to go embed SU2 into a bigger weak interaction group like SU3, this wouldn't work. If you try to go to supersymmetry, it doesn't work. If you try to go to a SU2 left cross SU2 right, it doesn't work. But no, it does work there, I'm sorry, something like it. But within the standard model, one gets by with a single Higgs doublet. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, you see it's taken me a whole hour, or practically a whole hour, just to write down the Lagrangian of the standard electroweak model. And on Monday, what I will do is I will apply spontaneous symmetry breaking. So, and talk a little about the Higgs mechanism, which is really pretty trivial at this stage. And then I have to rewrite every term I just wrote after the spontaneous symmetry breaking, identify mass eigenstates, and identify the physics. Okay, so that's where we will go next week.